This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Hello, and welcome to Birth to Work Radio. Our first Birth to Work radio segment today was recorded at the home of a very dear friend. For 15 years, Mr. Ed Renzi was the senior business leader of McDonald's, one of the most successful, visible, recognizable global Fortune 500 companies in the world. You'll hear Ed Renzi and me as we walk along a nostalgic path into his history, where he worked in a grocery store, he put coal inside of a stove and cans of food on the shelves, and remembers fondly the experience that that gave him as someone who developed the kind of qualities that led him to become more and more engaged as a leader and as an important part of the workforce of his small community, and eventually was the foundation for helping him become one of the most successful McDonald's Corporation leaders in the world. His workforce and his concerns regarding current and future workforce challenges are addressed as part of his discussion in the role that McDonald's Corporation played in being instrumental for many, many, many years in bringing kids into the service industry and providing them with work and training that they needed, with the only other person doing anything of the kind being a person. It was the institution, it was the Army. And he talks about this, and he talks about the importance of that early job experience and how kids miss that today in today's economy. He talks about Birth to Work and the thrill that it gave him to read our book, to look at what we're doing, and the solutions that we provided to meet challenges that are facing leaders today as they look to develop that capable workforce of the future.
Well, hello. This is Rick Stevens, and Elaine, it sounds like the dialogue you and Ed Renzi are going to have will really be a terrific one, helping community leaders, parents, and all of our listeners really get a good sense about what it means to launch into the workforce today and the skills necessary that enable people to be capable long through their career. The second half of our program will feature a discussion between myself and Ian Wigston, founder of ThoughtForge, a company based in the United Kingdom with its focus on emotional intelligence and leadership consulting. The two of us will discuss the common challenges of today's leaders, including meeting future workforce needs in Europe as well as the United States, and the need for collaboration across all economic sectors, education, business, health, government sectors, community organizations, and the media, in order to create effective and sustainable solutions to today's very complex economic problems. I think the watchwords from Ian you'll find out are, you can't go alone, and there are no silver bullets, so just stop looking for them. You know, the concepts around would you know a capable person if you met one is an important one, because I think it asks us all to address the question, what does it mean to be capable, particularly in society today? Second element about collaboration. You know, if communities are all about creating value in the economy and great places for people to work, to learn, to live, and to play, then this whole notion about collaboration, I think, needs to be defined, because we're all in these communities. And Elaine, as you all and I know, this is the foundation for the book that we co-authored, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, which we believe is a stunning revelation about the importance of creating capable people for the future workforce. Notably, in the conversation with Ian, he'll talk about our book's applicability and relevance, not just to community leaders in the U.S., but to European nations facing these very same issues. So with Elaine, let me turn it back to you, and you can launch into the discussion between you and Ed.
You were with McDonald's.
33 years.
33 years.
Did you pay attention in a specific kind of way to the workforce changes?
I didn't at the time, but reflecting back, and now that I've met you and Rick and have been thinking about this and looking back, I can see that there were dramatic shifts in the quality of output of work. And it happened at the time where we started losing teenagers that had a zeal for their first job. I am the product of a McJob. And McJobs were denigrated by unions and denigrated by politicians, and we don't want our kids to have McJobs, and we want them to do this, that, and the other things. We want them to go to college, and not every kid's going to be a college graduate. There's going to be bricklayers and carpenters, and we don't do anything to encourage youngsters to have that dream or desire to go that direction. And we don't have any systems in place to encourage them. If you look at most of the major unions in the United States, it's a father to son kind of thing. So African Americans and Hispanics are not brought into the trades at all because they just can't get into the apprentice programs. If your father was a carpenter and he was in good standing in union, then you could probably come in at the bottom level. But if your name was Jose and your dad was a migrant farm worker, there's no way you're going to get into the IBEW. It just isn't going to happen. So when I look back at McDonald's, I'm saying to myself, we used to hire the head cheerleader, the student council president, the football leaders, the baseball leaders, and they worked at McDonald's because it was cool, it was a great place to get that first job, there was discipline, there was education, there was training, and we prepared people for the next step. We used to say all the time that beyond the United States Army, we were the largest first job, entry-level job training program in the United States or the world for that matter. We taught youngsters how to look people in the eye and talk to them, say yes ma'am, no ma'am, to treat sanitation with respect, you know, and on and on and on and on, how to do basic mathematics and how to memorize orders, and we put them in school and gave them trade skills. I can't tell you the number of people that I've met in business that said, you know, my first job was at McDonald's and I really learned what it took to become a valued employee in my company at McDonald's. Today, there are no teenagers working at McDonald's. People working at McDonald's are desperate, either aliens or migrants or immigrants, and they're in there for survival, not job skill learning. When my four grandparents migrated from Europe, they turned their back on their home country and did not want to be known as Italian. They wanted to be known as Americans, and the consequence is they would not let anybody in our family speak Italian. We all had to speak English. Customs were rapidly gotten rid of. Now, when they were alone by themselves and we weren't around, they reverted to the Italian language and they would make their own wine and what have you. What we have today is an invasion. The people that are coming here today do not care to turn their back on their own country. What they're coming here for is the economic prosperity that may be here, to take advantage of that and then either go back or stay here but feed the system back home. I'm not going to pass judgment on why people want to leave Mexico and come here, or why they want to leave Middle Europe and come here. That's not for me to decide. What is for me to decide, I think our society can adapt and merge. But if we don't start educating people of the consequences of some of these behaviors, we're going to degrade to the point where the dream won't be there for anybody.
What I'm really interested in, Ed, is this notion of leadership. And when you and I first talked and you first said to me, you said, I'm not connected. You know, you said, I'm not connected in those echelons anymore. My heart just sank. And I thought, how is it that in our culture and in our environment, we don't look at someone who has 33 years experience, including 15 of those as head of one of the leading corporations on the planet, and say, I'm not connected the way I used to be?
Well, it's a legend today. You become persona non grata when you leave a company. No companies out there that embrace their senior executives ever coming back to do anything. You get the gold watch, you're out the door, and that's the end of it.
You just disappear. And so the question is, how do we as a culture fail? And it's not just schools, it's not just, you know, one system. It's the whole culture in which we live.
I've been thinking about solutions. To me, the future is everything, and the past is documentation. There's so much that I want to say about this, and I need a mirror to reflect these ideas off of, because I'm not just exactly sure what the right vocabulary is. As a society, we have gotten our leading executives to separate from the organizations that they ran, whether it's a public institution or it's a business or whatever it may be.
Nonprofit, everything.
To separate and say, I've done all I can do, it's time to turn it over to the next generation. And so they're basically surrendering and moving on. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to buy a house in Florida or Arizona and go there. Not because they necessarily want to go to Arizona, but because the staying where they are is painful. To realize that that institution you built, McDonald's, which is 7 miles down the road from where I live, no longer welcomes me, even in the parking lot. We have fainted our desire for the future because we can't handle the pain of staying where we're at. Look at the migration of baby boomers. What are they doing? They're buying houses in Las Vegas. You stop and think about the surreal world of Las Vegas. Why would anybody from Rockford, Illinois, or Hopedale, Ohio, want to move to Las Vegas? It's miserable hot. The morality isn't what I'm used to. I have no friends out there. I have no family out there. Well, I'm going because there's no tax. Come on. Are you going to something or are you running away from something? And in my estimation, so much of the migration you see really has to do with running away from something as opposed to going to something. That's why so many people come back. They do it 4 or 5 years and they find out, boy, there's a lot of emptiness down here.
Because the same motivation that drew them there, which is money, becomes less important when you realize that the true value is in your relationships. It's in the people that will support you. You can't have enough dollars to buy you the support that you need.
You can't buy relationships.
Hello and welcome back. This is part two of my discussion with former CEO executive Ed Renzi. I was so touched by the fact that here was a man who had so many different feelings and passion for what he learned. He wanted to share it, and he came back to us and he said, how can I take what I know and what you know and go forward and make a difference, because I think it's a better use of my skills and my time. And I think we're going to be very excited about that as we continue into the second segment of this interview.
You know, something that was really, really compelling to me when I read your stuff, that abstract, by the way, to me is a fantastic work of art and document. I grew up in rural Ohio. I think I told you this. And I started working when I was 10 years old. I worked at Jean Angel's grocery store stocking shelves. I worked at Presbyterian Church, putting coal in the furnace on Sundays, Thursdays for choir practice and Sundays for church. And I worked on my Uncle Monty's farm, baling hay and whatever else he wanted me to do. When I was 10 years old, my Uncle Monty sent me down over the hill to get his big tractor that had the big steel wheels with the steel cleats on it, hand brakes, one on each side that you had to pull to brake the thing. And I had to make so many decisions about what I was doing in that those work environments. You know, you've got to know what products to put on what shelf. You got to know how much coal to stick in the furnace. When you're 11 years old, how do you know how to do that? You only know it if somebody teaches you how to do it and you're stuck in the middle of doing it and you have to be self-reliant, you know. And I was making $4 a week from Jean Angel's, a penny a bale for hay, and $2 a week for firing the furnace. So I was making $7, $8, $9, $10 a week. And I got to keep a buck for 5 days worth of lunch at 20 cents a piece at the school, because lunches were 20 cents a piece at school. The rest I gave to my mom. She did whatever she did with it. And when I look back on that, that stuff that I did and worked at, coupled with what Danny Carrier, Leonard Costantini, Mrs. Wells taught me in school, is what allowed me to do what I did at McDonald's.
We did both. Could work. And it was the teaching.
Because I'm not a particularly smart person. And I had to work hard at what I did to get done what I got done. And I look today There's a huge piece missing in all that. And now you've got all these 30-year-olds, I say 30-year-olds, and I say that with a little bit of a sneer in my voice, that don't know how to make a decision. They have information in abundance, but can't use it for anything.
But I'm going to hold those same people, like yourself and ourselves and people who have been in these roles, accountable for not having recognized that we did very little to honor or to give language to or to celebrate that generation.
As I encounter people in my NASCAR business or the food company businesses I'm in and some other things, there are an awful lot of 25-year-olds to 35-year-olds that do not have an intelligent decision-making process. They're risk-averse. Their attitude is if I do what my boss did, I'll never be criticized for it. I don't intend to stay here that long anyway. If I can get 10% more somewhere else, I'm going to go. I don't have to be obligated to anybody or anything. How I live is only important insofar that I get enjoyment out of how I live. I don't work to be productive or make a contribution to a greater good. I work so that I can be hedonistic. So when I look at the business world and I deal with young people today in the business world, I am just astounded at how inept they are. Even though their companies are eminently successful, they are inept. They don't know how to take chances. They don't know how. They believe in incremental change. They don't believe in step change. They don't believe in the advancement of man. They don't believe in the advancement of anything in a geometric way. It's all arithmetic. And I see it everywhere I look. So when I look at the decision-making process in industry today, I don't see any sense of purpose in what they're doing.
What would you say attracted you to the birth to work agenda and the notion of systems as opposed to the way you were doing it, approaching the workforce issue?
What I zeroed in on was you and your... I wasn't sure what you believed, but I knew you believed it and believed it strongly. Then I read this abstract, and then I read this book, and then I say to myself, you better rethink about what the hell's going on here. So I started reading this thing, and I said to myself, I've been talking about the wrong things when I talk to business groups. I'm sitting over here talking about how to manage a business when, in fact, there may not be people to be customers or people to work in that business. And
that's exactly the issue.
And so if we're going to survive as a society, and we are the greatest society that's ever lived, in my opinion, because we have given people in a very large scale a sense of hope. And giving people hope is an incredible thing. And, you know, my grandfather knew nothing about the United States, knew nothing about America. He was working in a marble quarry in northern Italy where Michelangelo got his stuff. And he came over here to mine coal because of an idea, America, the land of hope and promise. We're losing that in spades. Look at how many immigrants now come to this country and are abused, disaffected. The whole idea that, the most poignant thing I've seen in the last 10 years, Israel's bombing the daylights out of Lebanon. And there, in Skokie, Illinois, there was a Jewish demonstration of support Israel, buy bonds, send money across the street where a bunch of Lebanese Americans holding up signs saying, get out of my country. Where are you today? Are you in America? Is America your country or is Lebanon your country? And why do they need to get out of America? Or are you talking to them about them getting out of Lebanon? I mean, the whole dichotomy, the confusion around all that. So I'm a believer that if we don't change the way we're doing business, in 100 years we won't exist. I really fear for our country. I see what's going on in China. I see what's going on in India. I see the outsourcing of all these jobs. I know what's happened with Snap-on tools, building tools in China versus building them in the United States. We are exporting our knowledge and not utilizing it ourselves. And McDonald's, as simple and as uncomplicated as it is, we no longer have McJobs. Nobody's talking about McJobs anymore. You know, and a McJob was an entry-level training position. And now the people that are occupying the jobs are not in entry-level jobs. They're careers. You know, and we cannot afford to have a society that has a minimum wage career. That's a transition. You know, once a kid learns how to bag French fries, then they ought to learn how to work on their front counter serving people, and then they ought to learn how to work as a team member in a complicated $3 million business. You know, McDonald's gives their young people responsibility at a very early age. And now we've got, instead of having McJobs, we've got McCareers at a minimum wage level with immigrants or newly arrived Americans that can barely speak English. And I use McDonald's because that's where I come from, but the fact of the matter is, you see it all over the place. It isn't just McDonald's. That's where the aha came from for me, because that's what I was closest to. But I see it everywhere.
People are using minimum wage jobs as careers.
Absolutely.
And if you,
and they should be transition jobs. They should not be permanent careers.
And if I said to you the whole idea of bringing this concept of building integrated stakeholder communities, it seems a little complex. On the other hand, it's really just a case of asking communities to take a look at whether or not they're going to continue to support that as a community.
Are we willing to have huge segments of our society that are stagnated in minimum wage jobs because they can't do more? My granddad left Italy because he came here for a greater good. He wanted to get above what he was at, where he was at. And his aspiration was that his son was going to do better than he did, and that his son's son would do better than he did, and his son's son, his great-great-grandson, would do better than all of them did.
Exactly.
And I don't think you see that today. I think good enough has become too easy. Good enough is good enough. And I very, very much want to leave this world a better place than when I came into it. I owe it to my mom and dad. I owe it to my grandparents. They gave up so much. And I want to do some good.
I think that every person that I talked to and had the privilege of working with in this whole venture that we've been on, Rick, has had the kind of heart in so many ways that Ed has. And my mother was an immigrant to this country as well, and I can tell you one thing. She came over, and she had a one-way ticket, and she made a commitment to being here. And the people who made a commitment to being here, like those forefathers that came over, they're the model and the example. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about make a commitment to make it work. We'll be right back.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips-Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
This system, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birthtowork.org or amazon.com.
This is Rick Stevens, and welcome back to Birth to Work Radio. Elaine, what a great segment and dialogue between you and Ed Renzi, and particularly this notion about you kind of get a one-way ticket, and it's about the value you bring that is so critically important to the communities in which we live. It's not just about take, it's what we give. The second half of our program today, again, would like to introduce you to the conversation between Ian Wigston, founder of ThoughtForge, a company based in the United Kingdom, and myself. You know, ThoughtForge is really focused on the emotional intelligence and leadership consulting to really help leaders at all levels, particularly in the business community, but across all areas, to really help understand what the implications are for developing the workforce of the future in the United Kingdom and Europe. So with that, let's launch into the discussion between Ian and myself.
Ian, what brings you here to America on this trip, and what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, there's two things, really, Rick. Firstly, I'd met you back at Heathrow a few months ago and have been in conversation with Elaine about the wonderful possibilities that Birth to Work is contemplating. So wanted to see whether the possibilities that we'd talked about could be born into reality. Perhaps it would be helpful to say a bit about ThoughtForge and about our work in education. We've been working in education for about 5 years now, on both ends of the street. We've worked with government in England. The Department of Education and Skills has an innovation unit, and we've been working with them on looking at new strategies for leadership of learning in schools. And then we've also been working with individual schools, both elementary and secondary, in helping leadership teams and also young people understand their learning habits, and in so doing, create a more coherent language within individual school communities. More recently, we've been working with leaders of community schools, which is principals and deputy principals who have to work with other cultures like social care, health, police, as well as other educators, in bringing together combined solutions for particular children, often in very challenged areas. And so the ideas that were articulated so brilliantly in your book, which I've now read a couple of times, I'm really excited about how we can bring those to life and can see some real opportunities for being able to put the thinking that's there in practice, not just in this country, but back in Europe as well.
So you see a fair amount of commonality between what's going on in the United Kingdom, probably Europe, and the same challenges and issues that we face here in America about preparing youth to be ready not only to be citizens, but also be ready for the workforce of the future.
Absolutely. In fact, the issues seem pretty much to be identical. We've struggled with the issues of business having to re-educate young people when they come into work, business discovering that the people that they thought they were hiring aren't the people that they were hiring, or business getting an image of somebody from an education establishment and then finding that challenged, you know, quite early on in the experience. So either the organization has to go through a massive and expensive retraining and re-educating, or in more extreme circumstances, the person has to leave the organization. The other thing that's a big concern is the balance of technical expertise that's coming through. Because just as in this country, there's a shortage of well-qualified technical teachers in the science subjects, but there's also a lack of appreciation of where the more creative and imaginative subjects can be brought to bear, both in technical areas and in more artistic areas. And so the issues are very, very similar. And what's concerning is there's not that much really good thought being given to how to bridge those gaps, partly because business tends to regard education with a level of suspicion. And education certainly regards business with a level of suspicion. So the people like Elaine and yourself and me who are trying to bridge those gaps often face some very difficult, not difficult questions so much as hard to overcome inbuilt prejudices, which take a lot of time, a lot of energy to diffuse before you can start the main substantive work you're trying to do.
Certainly here in America, and I'm sure in the United Kingdom, as you mentioned, business, educational institutions, and the government are all motivated to go get some alignment because they all see the same sets of statistical data that would lead one to believe that we have a problem going forward. Mm-hmm. You mentioned this notion about language or motivations. Why is it that with all of the resources, the energy, and the focus by each of these important organizations, do you see that we're not able to come together on a common language, therefore common perspectives, because everyone seems to have the same motivation, but everyone kind of wants to do their own thing or sees the view from a different perspective?
There's a lot of dogma involved, There's a lot of fixed points of view and a lot of inbuilt resistances to change. Certainly much of the academic world in both our countries has an orientation which is about ploughing their own furrow, as we would say, rather than trying to mould whatever is in their area of expertise to the greater good of an organisation or to a community. Government often will see it in terms of cycles, usually built around the election system, not always, and business will often see it in terms of a rigidity about numbers which doesn't allow for as much flexibility in cultural change or in some of the softer skills to be given the kind of prominence that they need. So they'll take a very qualified, intelligent engineer, and when that person struggles to communicate effectively, they kind of wonder why that is, and then look and realise that actually in their training, in their development, there's been nothing in the way of softer skills development or empathic development, emotional intelligence, if you like. One of the things that we've found is that the more intelligent somebody appears to be, the less effective they often are in practice, and vice versa. And so actually hiring somebody who's really, really bright might on the one hand solve a short-term problem, but unless there's a flexibility and they can do the second job that they were asked to do, not just the first job, then their usefulness to an organization is reduced.
In the book, The System, Seeking the Soul of Commerce, Elaine Scott and I tried to help provide a framework so that people could see themselves in a community and all of the various roles that go on and the challenges that everyone has, again, with language. Do you see this having applicability beyond America? And if so, is the context from a community perspective something that others could relate to?
Very much so. One of the great things about the book is the consistency and the accuracy and the truthfulness in the dialogue. And you could transplant the community that's in the book into pretty much any town in England, certainly. And I think that the power of the message is also in the degree to which the community realizes that if it's going to be successful as a community, there are different roles that each group has to play, and that no one group has a lead role for any period of time. There's a genuine sense of holding one another by the hand and being able to pass the baton, if you like, from person A to person B in order for the individual or the group with the most appropriate skill coming to the fore and then allowing other parts of the system to do what they need to do.
Key and part of all this is about getting community stakeholder leaders to adopt a set of shared values that then lead to shared vision. Mm-hmm. Our experience, and based upon our discussions before, I think your experience is that most leaders want to come to the table with the solution to the problem rather than kind of backing away and sharing their thoughts and ideas and evolving the discussion around a set of shared values. What's your sense of some of the challenges about helping community leaders think differently? Because in most of their environments, they are about bringing solutions, not about backing away and listening to others.
It's a very good point. We see this with head teachers and principals in particular as an example. Often we'll say that we assert most when we're least secure. And the typical model of a successful principal in the past would have been a very charismatic, strong leader individual who would be setting out a position and pulling everybody towards it. What's increasingly the case is that, for a start, the number of leaders like that that are in the pipeline is small. Certainly the demographics in the English education system are such that the majority of head teachers are going to be retiring and the numbers to fill the gap are not there in the next 5 to 10 years. But also the model is changing because the newer, more effective teachers are the ones who are able to ask the right questions and perform more of the role of the coach than the person who's dragging an organization to the promised land, if you like. And so living with the ambiguity and living with the possibility that the answer might be different from what you'd envisaged, but actually brings each and every stakeholder along with it, it is the skill that we have to ingrain and the skill that we have to encourage. And so it's going to be more around that willingness to engage and ask great questions and be prepared to hear and work with answers that weren't originally in the pipeline is going to be key.
This is Rick Stevens, and welcome back to our second segment of the dialogue between Ian Wigston and myself, Ian of ThoughtForge, on Birth to Work Radio.
So, Ian, just before the break, we were talking about really this new thought process for leaders and the importance for them to consider the role they play as opposed to being directive, but being ones who are more willing to facilitate and have greater ambiguity in the thought process. Can you comment on your thoughts in this area?
As I was alluding to earlier, Rick, the nature of leaders in education, in business, is changing. And the idea that a single individual can provide all the answers has always been a fallacy, in my view. And so leadership has always been about embracing a collective view. I think that the power of ideas and the power of possibility is increasingly going to come into play here, because an organization can move very, very quickly through an idea which is communicated and which is adopted, so that so long as the person having the idea isn't too precious about it and can recognize the distinction between creating an idea, communicating the idea, and implementing the idea, then those three roles need to cohere very quickly. And often it's not about getting hold of the biggest budget. And I've worked in organizations where the more budget you had, the more budget you controlled, the bigger and powerful you were. But there's a downside to that as well, because if you're lending money and that goes bad, then you aren't going to get promotion by having the biggest bad debt book. And sometimes just being able to identify the preciousness of a resource or the leverage that a particular resource can bring about. I'll give you an example. We're working with a principal in England who took over a school which was struggling in its particular locality. And he asked the question, why can't this school be more like Disneyland? And the reason he asked that was that if you took an elementary school pupil on a wet winter's day and they got a cold, would they feel like going to school normally? Probably not. But if they were at Disneyland, they would sure as heck get out of bed and walk with their mum and dad down the road to Disneyland. And so if the school could be made to feel more like an adventure, more like a set of possibility, how much more that would motivate not just the pupils, but also the teaching staff. That school now, 3 years on, is one of the best performing schools in that particular locality. It has its own radio station, has its own newspaper, it has its own cafe where the students learn and talk French. And that's run by the students. And this is pupils who are between 5 and 10 years old. And so to the idea that adults need to do that stuff, actually, no, they don't. So you give the possibility and you give that opportunity to a group of young people, create the environment which allows them to do that. And then in terms of that resource, you just see them grow and blossom. The other thing that's important in that is that the leader can't be afraid of bringing people into the group that are brighter than him or her. So often I think leadership in the past has been constrained by the need to hire someone that I can feel comfortable controlling and managing, that is dumber than me. And guess what? That's the limit of the organization's ambition. My intelligence, or lack of it. So I think that new leadership and system leadership, those are just a couple of aspects of it. But those are indicative, I think, of what we're trying to say.
In this environment that you described about a school that's very proactive, creating opportunities, possibilities, I think is what you said, for students going forward, whether it's radio stations or basically similar to what would happen in the real world. Many today believe that it is important to have educational standards from which there can be concrete measurements relative to performance about how much students know, you know, in terms of knowledge versus how they're able to demonstrate it. This certainly creates a paradox for some about, well, if I've got this neat standard I can measure, versus in the real world, it's not about standards, it's really about performance. Can you comment on, you know, how to help educators recognize, and I'll say politicians recognize, what this new environment ought to look like as opposed to this regimentation about I told you, therefore I can test you, therefore I can verify you have the knowledge.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the debate in England is often around standards versus structures. And of course, the answer is that they need to work in harmony together. But what tends to happen is that you'll get one government saying, let's push for standards, and then 4 years later, somebody else comes in and say, let's go for structures. And so you throw out all of the good work that's been done in the previous regime, because what you're trying to do is to show that your solution is best. I think, you know, the arts provide a great example in this. If we walked into the Louvre and saw, you know, a painting or a sculpture by Michelangelo, we would know greatness when we saw it. And equally, we know greatness when we see it in sports teams, when we see it in great works of art. And so the problem is defining the notion of greatness when you see it in young people. And Jim Collins, who wrote the book Good to Great, recently produced a very, very good accompaniment to Good to Great called Good to Great in the Social Sectors, which is basically his attempt to say, how can we bring some of these concepts that characterize great organizations in the private sector into other environments like education and health and so on? And the point he makes in that excellent monologue is to say, don't just copy business, because most of what business does is mediocre. What you should do is copy and adopt greatness. And what he does is to take the language of Good to Great and put it into a social sector environment very cleanly and very coherently. And it's something which a lot of the leaders that we're working with are recognizing, because there is this mantra which sometimes goes around about do what business might do. And as I said earlier, that often tends to encourage suspicion and negative thinking from people that work in the social sector. And actually, much of what they're being asked to copy or mimic isn't that great in the first place. So I would say, the leader's job in the education environment and the kind of communities that we're talking about is a very demanding one, because there are not a lot of great role models, and there are an awful lot of people trying to say, go copy that person over there, when actually the issues that that person over there has to deal with are a million miles away. And what I think is really vital about the kind of community engagement that you're encouraging is that selectively, practices from business can be adopted. But equally, the values and the criteria that drive and motivate the public sector need to be inculcated, not just in the public, but also in business as well. Because I've certainly worked in banking with people whose values and ethics would be questionable, but are encouraged to behave in that way by leaders that have a goal which is very, very singular and usually built just around one thing, the achievement of a financial gain.
So what I think I hear you saying is the whole educational process isn't as much about knowledge as it is about the results to be able to solve problems in a creative and effective way. Many of the challenges that exist today from an educational perspective is measurement tied to standards, but ultimately what people are going to be measured on is their success out in society, and that comes in a number of measurable ways.
Yeah, another head I know would say that the league tables that we have to work on in England, they measure all of the things that actually are short-term, and none of the things like, is this person going to be a good citizen? Are they going to be a lifelong learner? Are they going to be a worthwhile member of their community? I think it was Bobby Kennedy who said something similar, that we measure everything apart from the things that really matter. And so if there is a leavening of those measures with longer-term and more deep-seated ideological goals, that's the kind of approach, which isn't about being soft on those numbers, but it's about actually making those numbers much more rigorous in terms of the holistic values that they bring and the kinds of enduring, sustainable qualities that they encourage in young people.
So, Ian, given the challenges we just talked about, who from the community really needs to be engaged going forward? And if we're going to come up with the solutions that we need to help this broader educational system?
I think that anybody who is a learner or considers himself to be a learner has a role to play. We did a piece of work a couple of years ago where we paired up education and business communities in a learning challenge, which was basically to say, in business, do you reckon that you've got all the answers as far as learning is concerned? do you reckon you've got all the habits of mind pinned down? And by the same token, what can education learn about some of the disciplines and some of the processes that business would bring to bear in a similar situation? And the dialogue was fascinating. And what came out was that the business community saw that their capacity to learn was something which they'd forgotten, and the educators saw that their suspicion about business could be tempered by seeing business money spent in a particular way and initiatives actually taken care of by business rather than just being given as some sort of philanthropic gesture that was then forgotten as soon as the check was out of the door. And so that calls for a genuine engagement two ways. And you can make it more complicated than that because there are other elements that need to be brought in. We've had some very sad situations in England recently where different stakeholders have failed to adequately collaborate or combine together to meet the needs of particular groups of people. Challenged children, children under threat, children in social care, and so on. And what's been alarming about that has been the resistance that many of those groups have shown to the idea of effective collaboration improving the chances for young people. And there's been too much dogma and self-centeredness around particular disciplines and particular cultures having unique solutions rather than combining to bring about a much stronger and more sustainable solution for that individual group. And that's where true learning takes place, in being able to see, yes, I recognize and respect what you can bring, and here's how I need to change and orientate myself differently, even though it might mean a cost to me in terms of having to relearn something.
Terrific. Well, Ian, this has been a terrific discussion. Really appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you today. It's good to see you again, and we'll look forward to seeing you again soon.
Rick, it's been my pleasure, and I hope that you can make it across our side of the pond before too long.
I look forward to it.
Well, Elaine, what a great discussion, and Ian brings such terrific insights about what we call the soul of commerce. It's about people at all levels, leaders in all areas, really coming together and bringing their soul to the table about their hearts, their thoughts, their ideas, and their leadership, and then the resources to be able to collaborate and make the communities really places where people want to learn, live, work, and play, and come back to each and every time they continue to develop and evolve in this ever-changing world economy.
At Birth to Work, we've pioneered a way forward for communities, community leaders, and those who work on behalf of the economic growth of the communities that they work in, to systemically come up with solutions by promoting the development of engaged leadership. Leadership that's really focused on people for the future. In our Integrated Community Leadership and Stakeholder Development Certificate, we have a training module showcasing a way for leaders from multiple sectors to come together, join forces across what have been invisible barriers in the past, much the way Ian was talking about, and saying, come on, folks, let's put down our territorial issues and let's put down our differences. We've talked about this with a number of our guests, and let's work together. Schools have got to work with city council. City council has got to work with the local health agencies. They must talk to each other, and this is what we're about.
It's really about the new methods for aligning those actions that build capable people of the future. You know, our leadership training class is facilitated by Birth to Work and offered for college extension credit for those who qualify. For additional information on Birth to Work, the leadership and stakeholder classes, the book, and other archived radio programs, please visit Birth to Work website. That's birth2work.org. Birth to Work, igniting community leadership to create capable people for the future. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birth2work.org. That's birth2work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birth2work.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.